Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The men on the ground believe that what they're doing is they're creating an army. So the United States military, the regular military, the tanks, helicopters, guns, and parachutes types of guys, don't have to put boots on the ground in Africa.
You're listening to War College, a weekly podcast that brings you the stories from behind the front lines. Here are your hosts, Matthew Galt and Jason Fields.
Hello, welcome to War College. I'm Matthew Galt.
And I'm Jason Fields.
A report dated a few years ago said U.S. Special Forces were operating in more than 90 countries. Recently, we learned one of those was Niger, Africa. And the only reason the public knows anything about it is because of four fatalities among the U.S. troops involved in the fight. This week, we're going to talk about what happened and what America's military is doing in Africa. Joining us are former Green Beret and current SoftRap.com reporter Derek Gannon, as well as show favorite Joseph Trevithick, who's been following America's wars in Africa for years and currently reports on them for thedrive.com. Okay, so let's get the basics out of the way. Derek, we'll start with you. What happened?
So basically what happened, what we know and what we found out over at SoftRep pretty much within a couple hours of the incident was that a Green Beret team that was there in Niger on a JSET or a joint combined training exercise with the Nigerian government and military were assigned to about 30 Nigerian special troops out of an intelligence brigade out of the Nigerian military. And they were in the southwest region of Niger in the Tillaberi region, just outside of a village called Tongo Tongo. Now, their mission initially was to basically find ground intelligence. I'm going to use that word very specifically. On a individual with a known Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb and Islamic State in the Greater Sahara ties that was operating in the southwestern region of Niger doing some cross-border operations. Now, what they did was they went to that village under local intelligence to try to – what's kind of coming out is not maybe even capture him, but more than likely collect intelligence on his operations. And then if they could capture what we believe is the Islamic State in the Greater Sahara's leader, his name's Abu Walid Sarhawi. They got to that position. He and his folks were not there. So they started to return back to their base camp in the Tillaberi region of Niger. And they stopped over near a village called Tongo Tongo. And so basically they stopped in the village of Tongo Tongo to have the Nigerian military use it as an outpost, and they were resupplying there. The Green Beret team that was there was a force of 12 with this as of yet unknown number of special forces support soldiers, namely the two that were killed, Jeremiah Johnson and LaDavid Johnson, were support soldiers, and they were mainly using those folks as drivers of the lightly armored technical vehicles or four-wheel drive vehicles that they were using in the region. So what the Green Beret team and the Green Beret command did was they split the team up half and half, like we usually do. Half of them stayed with the convoy, the other half decided to have a meeting with the local leaders. So what we used to call a key leadership engagement or meeting. What is known now as elements of the Islamic State in the Greater Sahara that's being led by this Zarhawi fella knew of their whereabouts. The region of southwest region of Niger is a very Fulani nomadic tribe heavy, which the ISIS in the Greater Sahara, AQIM and Boko Haram recruit from heavily. And it is believed that neighborhood that they were in or village that they were in were sympathetic to the Islamic State ideals, so to speak. And were basically delaying the special forces team from leaving the actual village itself so they could allow these terrorist forces to set up an ambush, which they did in the it was about a 50 plus size force, split them in half, and the team was pretty much left on the ground without air support and fought these folks for about an hour until the French Mirages flew overhead and the French special forces with their Pumas showed up.
Can we talk for a minute about what this mission was really all about? I have a question that for me spans across the whole plan in Africa. Now, I can make it a little more specific than that. But who is Sahrawi? And we think he's a high value target. What does that even mean in a case like that? Do we think this guy is coming here to the United States? Is he really going to come to my house and blow it up? I mean, if you can explain like who these guys are and why we're there, that'd be great.
Well, I'll answer your last question first. Absolutely no, Zarqawi or the Islamic State cannot nor will come to the United States. That's their dream. They don't, do not possess the manpower to travel to the United States. So who is Zarqawi? Well, that kind of delves down into the history of the West African sub-Saharan region of homegrown terrorism. Zarqawi came from a group known as the Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb. Now, that's an amalgamation of a couple West African Salafist-leaning terrorist organizations that have been operating in the Western African Sahel region that the French have been dealing with for years. And one of the main forces of the Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb is a group known as the Al-Marbutin. And I can't do a lot of good French accents, so imply the French with that name because it is Algerian French. This group was led because I'll get to that point in a second, by a man named Mokhtar Belmokhtar, otherwise known as Lahore or the One Eye or the Marlboro Man. Now this guy's an interesting guy. He's been around the jihad since the late 70s, early 80s. When he traveled from West Africa, his areas in Algeria, where he's from, to Afghanistan in the early 80s and got trained in the bin Laden camps when, you know, unfortunately, we were supporting the Mujahideen against the Soviets. Learned all of that information and all that fun stuff in the camps, the bin Laden camps in Afghanistan. And that's where he lost his eye, actually. He was juggling a Soviet grenade as a joke during a training exercise. And, you know, I think he dropped it and lost his eye. He came back to Africa after that and brought his Al-Qaeda ideals with him and started up small groups of mass brigade, ones who bathed in blood, the Al-Marbutin, and then it just became, he pledged fealty to the Al-Qaeda Central, as we call it, and reflagged under the Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, known as Al-Marbutin. Now, Zarqawi was an up-and-coming, he's a young guy, he's an up-and-coming commander who was, it's been rumored that Mokhtar himself groomed this young man into being a Salafist leader. Mokhtar Belmokhtar, we like to call him the Teflon Jihadi, because nobody really knows if he's dead or not, because the United States has said they drone struck him four or five times. So Zarqawi became kind of disillusioned with the Arab strong ideals of Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, and was really, really, really enamored by al-Baghdadi's declaration of the caliphate and the way the Islamic State is kind of a younger, more social media hip, you know, apocalyptic terror group. He decided to take his brigade of his loyalists with him, sliced off from the al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, pledged his fealty to al-Baghdadi and started raising a black banner of the Islamic State and named it the Islamic State in the Greater Sahara. And this was in late 2016. Since then, a lot of these West African regions around there has a lot of nomadic tribes. And then there's a bigger one, the biggest one called the Fulani tribe. He began to recruit heavily from the Fulani, as well as another group that does that as well is Abu Bakr Shakau's Boko Haram, which is situated in the Lake Chad Basin, which has been operating with impunity in southwest Niger. He has, you know, caviar dreams of becoming the man who reunites the Maghreb, if you will, with the caliphate. And, you know, that's where we're at right now. He's been in a heavy, heavy recruiting binge along the tri-border area, the Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger.
Joe, you've been covering the American military in Africa for years. How does all of this fit in with the big picture there?
This has been going on for some time, and recently at a unprecedented press conference, really, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Joseph Dunford, pointed out that the mission in Niger has been going on for at least two decades, and it predates the 9/11 terrorist attacks. And it's become significantly more important since the collapse of Muammar Gaddafi's regime and his subsequent execution in Libya following a Western-backed intervention there in 2011. And he had been more or less holding back a number of the nomadic and other sort of terrorist groups that we've just heard about in great detail. And a significant number of those long time, not just jihadis, but, you know, their Tuaregs and their Fulani, and there were other people who had a variety of disparate grievances against a number of different regimes. You know, Muammar Gaddafi had been very impressed by their reluctance in many cases to acquiesce to the government of Chad, who he had waged a war against. And so, you know, these people had been in the region for some time. And after Muammar Gaddafi's regime collapses, they get together their guns and they raid a few state arms dumps and they drive straight across the desert into northern Mali and precipitate a crisis there that ultimately leads to a coup that overthrows the government in that country. And then the situation completely goes off the rails, prompting a U.S.-backed French intervention. And that's in January 2013. And that brings sort of to the fore the latest incarnation of this really long-standing mission that is now very much concerned with providing support to this ongoing counterterrorism and peacekeeping effort that is both African and French predominantly in Mali. There is an ongoing crisis in Libya that has taken on a number of new dimensions in the past couple of years. There is, you know, what we've already heard about with these crises in the tri-border region on the other end of Niger due to Boko Haram. And so Niger has, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, depending on how you look at it, become an exceptionally strategic country located right in the middle of this very bad neighborhood. And the United States begins to expand its presence there in particular. These individuals who were ambushed in Niger earlier in October were conducting a mission in support of this overarching counterterrorism campaign plan, which is nicknamed Operation Juniper Shield. Mm-hmm. And so that's what's driving this strategy throughout this portion of Africa, the north and western region of what's called the Sahel. And you'll hear this. And the Sahel is a term for basically where the Sahara Desert ends, but before true sub-Saharan Africa begins. And it's this intermediate sort of desert scrub portion of the continent that has a ton of what we like to call ungoverned space, where central governments simply do not have the capacity to exercise their authority. They may not even know what's out there in terms of the basic geography. A lot of what the United States has been doing over the last decade has been just helping countries like Niger map out their own country, because there's not a lot of population centers. And that's exactly why these terrorist groups can drive about in their technicals and flourish with significant impunity is just because it's exceptionally difficult to maintain control over vast areas that are virtually inhospitable. So, I mean, that sort of gives you a broad picture of what you're talking about here and why it's so fluid and why it can be so difficult to get a grasp on it for people who haven't been following it for so long.
That makes so much sense. And Niger is also, if I understand right, it's one of the absolute poorest places on Earth, right? And the government has been remarkably unstable, and they've had a number of coups in the last few years, too. So they're not going to make much in terms of partners for the United States.
Well, I just want to jump in there. They did have a coup in 2010. Since then, the government there has been exceptionally stable compared to its neighbors.
I'm just old, Joe. 2010 seems like yesterday to me.
No, it is. There are a lot of coups in the region. It's important to point out. It's exceptionally important to point out how Niger came to be the center of gravity is in no small part that the center of one of the more important centers of gravity was initially in Mauritania, and there was a coup in Mauritania, and then it shunted into Mali, and then after the Tuaregs and Ansar Dine, the Islamists showed up in 2012, mm-hmm. and the coup there shunted the center of gravity largely into Burkina Faso, which then started to experience political instability around 2012, 2013 itself, which then also further prompted this push into Niger. I have a document from Africa Command, and as of 2011, Niger was second to last of eight countries in engagement priority. So it's not a given. You know, stability in this part of Africa is unfortunately not a given. These regimes have do very dubious human rights records, don't really tolerate political dissent. Is Niger worse than any other? I would really not want to get into that. But, you know, there are issues. There are definitely issues, and it's worth pointing out for sure.
Yeah, there's definitely a no set ranking structure on who the best worst option in Africa. He's absolutely correct. That would be hard to gauge, actually.
Why does the military have authorization to be fighting there on behalf of America? How did that happen? I think that's another big picture question a lot of people are asking. Is this a declared war?
The AUMF is the much bigger issue.
Oh yes.
You know, that law was passed in the aftermath of the 9/11 terrorist attacks and was intended to give President George W. Bush the freedom to more or less go after Al-Qaeda in all of its forms anywhere it existed at the time. It has been used ever since then by both President Obama and now by President Trump to authorize military action against associate groups or groups that can be determined by a very expert U.S. government lawyers to be associated with global Al-Qaeda. This has been used to authorize action against Islamic State, which is an evolution of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. So, and now that there's sort of been this bunny hopping, legally speaking, that since Islamic State in Iraq and Syria is understood to be an evolution of Al-Qaeda in Iraq and covered under the 2001 authorization of the use of military force law, that then associate groups of Islamic State are, as a result, also covered by that extension. I laugh, and I really shouldn't laugh, but it is how the United States has waged war against terrorists across the globe for the last 16 years. And there has been no end of talk about Congress repealing that law and passing a new one to compel the United States government to come up with a new argument, which has generally gained no traction. Mainly because I think that most politicians would prefer to stay away from this debate because it brings up really annoying questions of, well, you were in favor of this for a very long time, but now suddenly there's been this one thing that apparently makes it no longer okay. And, you know, that may not matter for you and me. It may not matter for the vast majority of Americans. It may not matter for the vast majority of people who live in the places that we were conducting counterterrorism operations, but it matters when it's the exact kind of soundbite that can pop up in an attack ad. And so it matters to these people. It matters to why Lindsey Graham can say he had no idea that there were, you know, more than 800 troops, you know, 800 to 1,000 troops in Niger one day, and then a week later he can say, we need more troops in Niger. We definitely need more troops in Niger. I mean, that's how this happens. Mm-hmm. So.
All right, listeners, we're going to pause here for a quick word from our sponsors. We'll be back after this.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Thank you for listening to War College. You are back on with Derek Gannon and Joseph Trevithick, and we are talking about America's wars in Africa. So, Derek, where does the buck stop militarily? I mean, obviously with the president, right? And there's a whole mess of people in Washington, but who's running the show on the ground there?
Well, I want to touch on the authorized use of military force for just a second, if I could.
Definitely.
That authorized use of military force against, in the title tells you exactly how broad spectrum it is. It's authorized use of military force against terrorist organizations. And that was written into law the 18th of September, 2001, literally not less than a week after 9/11. And since then, the AUMF, as it's been parsed down, is literally the global war on terror. It is an open bounty on any, and what was touched on was, and on any Al-Qaeda affiliated terrorist groups. It's just in the 16 years that this blanket war decree of a global war on terrorism has been around, it's just kind of absorbed new terrorist organizations instead of just Al-Qaeda affiliates as a whole. For instance, in 2008, as Harakat al-Shabaab in Somalia had yet to pledge their loyalty to Al-Qaeda Central, and they're more of a Eastern regional terrorist organization trying to create an African caliphate. And in exactly. the early 2009s, I believe the then leader of the Al-Qaeda, or excuse me, of al-Shabaab, pledges loyalty to Al-Qaeda, which split that terrorist organization in two because half wanted to stay national for an African caliphate. The other guys wanted to go pro and go international. So the AUMF is literally what we call the global war on terror. It is an open-ended decree from President Bush that the Obama administration and what has just been mentioned, the Trump administration has literally used and has touched little. Now, with that being said, where the buck stops with it politically, obviously, is with the Senate Armed Services Oversight Committee. If they're not getting these weekly, daily, monthly briefings on special operations and special forces missions, specifically in Africa, then maybe these folks should not be sending their interns to some of these meetings and actually listen to what is going on in these closed door sessions. As far as militarily, where does the buck stop? The buck always stops at the Department of Defense, obviously, and the command. And if you really want to get technical, the commander in chief is overall authority over the United States military. We know that. But militarily, where the buck stops and where the information flow, I think, is bottlenecking, as it always has. And it's not their fault. There's a lot of information coming through these doors. Is literally the Pentagon itself. And how do you deal with every other week? There's either we are, two DEFCONs away from launching a first strike on North Korea, to the very next thing is that Lindsey Graham comes out of a closed door session with General Mathis, and all of a sudden in an ad hoc press briefing says you're going to expect to see more special operations and U.S. military actions in Africa, not less, and also alluded to the fact that they're actually going to have a meeting. And changing the rules of engagement for advisors that are already on the ground to where instead of a defensive posture, meaning if you feel that your life is in danger or threat, you can engage a target, now to where all that you're actively looking at is involved with, engaged, and or supporting a terrorist organization, you can openly engage them. That, to me, is a declaration of a low-intensity conflict, otherwise known as a war. But that's my opinion, but that's not what was on paper. The military... there's a lot of covering up, these risk assessments. Was the team prepared? Was the team underprepared? Did they lack combat experience? Which my counterpoint to that is, I know of several of my close friends and several of members of the teams of Green Berets that infiltrated Northern Afghanistan as America's response in October of 2001 that had little to no combat experience and routed and destroyed the Taliban in 8 weeks. So that argument doesn't hold water with when you talk about special operations and special forces soldiers in general. As far as where the buck stops, it's always, I'm not saying that the teams can run amok without any oversight. The buck militarily is going to stop with SOC AFRICOM. It's going to stop with SOC AFRICOM and then the Pentagon itself. And in essence, Special Operations Command, along with the major commands, such as the Department of Defense, really need to kind of figure out, are we briefing Congress good enough, which I tend to believe, having spent 16 years in special operations and in the military, the amount of paperwork that I've had to write for after action reviews, I hope someone's reading those. So this is where we're in the gray zone. We don't really know right now. This is a new war. This is a new battlefront that a lot of Americans don't know. And as Jim pointed out, we've been in Africa for decades. I mean, honestly, since the 60s. It was a huge Cold War proxy, you know, tug of war battleground, 60s and the 70s. And then, you know, China, Russia and India and the United States started looking at Africa as a really, really, really good strategic natural resource grab. So, you know, the permanent five of the United Nations Security Council, which involves the major first worlders, if you will, have been involved with their fingers in Africa for a while. So where does that's a great question. I don't know if I could even answer it or have. Where does the buck stop and how do we deal with the fallout from that?
It doesn't sound like you guys are describing any kind of clear and present danger to the United States, right? Why are we there?
Why are we there? It does not. There is no clear and present danger that I can see other than already mitigated positions, you know, stopgaps put in place that I see to the sovereignty, if we're going to use large words, of the homeland or the United States. What I see is an operation and a mission with the heavy use of, like, I, you know, these Green Berets, who are somewhat, and I know this is a weird term, somewhat of an armed anthropologist themselves, to go in there and assess the situation and try to build up a host nation itself. Now, that is a small footprint. I think you have to look at a couple mitigating factors. One, I'll be political for a second. You have to look at the 2014 cease of combat operations in Afghanistan was a huge win for the Obama administration and a lot of his base. However, that money had to go somewhere. That money had to go somewhere. The funds for Operation Enduring Freedom Afghanistan were shifted, and correct me if I'm wrong, Jim, were shifted to initially the Horn of Africa for the Siege of Sotah HOA, which is the combined joint Special Operations Task Force and the Horn of Africa, but got an influx of not only funding and equipment, but troop count from Operation Enduring Freedom Afghanistan, which was then shifted over to Africa under the moniker of Operation Enduring Freedom Trans-Sahara. And under this blanket AUMF, like, have as many missions against counterterrorism missions have started, Operation Juniper Shield came of that. So
yeah, I mean, it was coming a bit before then too. And cause you saw it as the drawdown, because the drawdown in Afghanistan had been discussed for a long time. And so then that emphasis shifted, and you know, the big way you saw this, and you just mentioned it there about the influx in troop count, was that when a third special forces group, the Army's third special forces group, more or less got freed up from this thing in Afghanistan, they were immediately retasked to North and West Africa, and they became primary troop provider there,
which was their original area of operations prior
exactly,
to 9/11.
Yeah.
So, look, please tell me that I'm wrong, but what you both have said, it sounds to me like they're there because the money had to go somewhere, the momentum had to go somewhere, and the bureaucracy is running on autopilot.
I would say that a lot of that is correct in a way, but it's also long been the position of the United States, and this is a Cold War mentality. It's long been the position of the United States that stable regions are in U.S. interests. And if you want to pick unstable regions, I mean, you could do a lot worse than picking North and West Africa. And I think rightly some time ago, it became at least in sort of dark corners of the Pentagon and of the State Department that Africa was going to become this sort of perpetual nightmare. And if there's something that's running on autopilot, it's the idea that we need to help in Africa. There's also a really nasty post-colonial legacy in Africa, which impacts just how much Westerners especially can do visibly. And beyond needing to do something, it's still been this operational backwater. And it's long been that way. When U.S. Africa Command was created at the tail end of the Bush administration, when the idea for a dedicated command for Africa was formalized, which came into being fully in 2008, it was billed as something that was going to be totally different from all of the other regional military commands that we have. And there was going to be this heavy integration with both the State Department and with the U.S. Agency for International Development. And this was exceptionally important because people sort of were of the view that the security component was important, but it was still relatively minor compared to the fact that significant parts of Africa just did not have clean drinking water, and significant parts of Africa simply did not have access to basic medical support. And that if you were going to talk about drivers for security problems, people without clean drinking water and people without access to basic government services who have, you know, only experienced weak institutions, well, those people are the bread and butter of militant groups, and not even just terrorist groups. I mean, just militant groups up, down, and sideways on the spectrum. I mean, if you want to recruit people who are not starving, because starving people can't fight, but on the verge of starving and who are tired of seeing leadership figures driving around in their Mercedes, well, there is a ton of those people in Africa because that's sort of the way it is at the moment. And I think somebody said, we really need to do something about that. And then somebody said, yes, we are now going to do something about that. And now that's been what's sort of running on autopilot is this, mm-hmm. is that, you know, and you hear it at every single one of these official briefings, and people say, what are we doing in Africa? They ask this, you ask the question you've asked, what are we doing in Africa? And they give the stock answer in this bureaucratic speak. You know, we are building partner capacity. We are supporting, you know, the development of democratic institutions. We are doing all these things and, you know, never really getting down into the nitty gritty of how and mm-hmm. what are your metrics. And right now, the most common metric, and this is something I've heard, especially from the development community, friends of mine who worked in Africa, they say the metric is money spent. It's always money spent. And that's an exceptionally common metric in international development. It's not an uncommon metric in military operations. Money spent. And the easiest way to do that, of course, is to plus up on overhead. And so you hear guys talk about USAID projects and they're 70% overhead. So you build a well, but you're also staying in a village, private security. And most of it actually goes into keeping your guys pretty comfortable in Africa rather than building the actual well. And so, you know, this is where the disconnect occurs in the overarching strategy, such as it is, and how it gets implemented on the ground. And I think we're starting to see a certain amount of that just in the way that the Pentagon really wants the public to understand what we're doing in Africa. Of course they do. I hate people saying it's like, you know, they're obfuscating and it's like, you know, there's a conspiracy or something. It's like, no, they really desperately want you to understand what the U.S. military is doing in Africa and why you should care about stability in North and West Africa, because they do care. They just can't explain it either. And that's a problem. That's an exceptionally significant problem. If they can't explain what everybody seems to, as a rule, understand to be an important goal, well, then how do you think that translates into how the operation is being fulfilled?
That's true. I think the Pentagon really, I agree with you. I think the Pentagon wants desperately for us to understand them, and they feel that they're speaking English, but the Pentagon and regular Americans speak two different languages, and neither one of them can understand it or learn it because it changes almost quarterly. They really do want us to understand, but what I can tell you is from a Green Beret perspective on the ground, these guys believe that their operations are integral to regional stability. That's why they think they're there, building the wells, in the 18 deltas, the special forces medics, literally building and creating field hospitals and training up specialized medics so then those medics that they train can train other medics, establishing medical care, supplies, buildings, also training them to defend and attack and become a force, not unlike what we created in Chad, to protect themselves. Because Joe was correct, the United States really likes regions that are stable. Well, how do you destabilize a region that has been so far unstable for the last 20 years? You send in special forces, you send in these Green Berets to empower the local host nation through training of what they understand through guerrilla and irregular warfare tactics. And then they implement that into their own countries. And the men on the ground believe that what they're doing is they're creating an army. So the United States military, the regular military, the tanks, helicopters, guns, and parachutes types of guys don't have to put boots on the ground in Africa.
All right. Thank you guys so much. Derek Gannon, Joseph Trevithick, thank you guys for coming on War College.
Thanks for listening to this week's show. We hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please leave a review on iTunes. It helps other people find the show. One user, Mr. Petkus, left us a 5-star review. Here's what he had to say. War College is on the short list of excellent podcasts that explore our military-industrial complex. Well, we'll be trying to do more of that next week. My name is Jason Fields, and my partner on the show is Matthew Galt. We split up the producing duties ever since Bethel Habte left us for greener pastures. You can reach us. We are at facebook.com/warcollegepodcast. We're also on Twitter, which is @war_college.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.